I would just say if anybody else joins, maybe do a debrief. I would hate to.
Yeah, if anyone else joins, I'll do a debrief. But if they don't, unless you all read ahead preparing for that.
I wish I could say yes.
So we'll jump ahead. All right. Welcome, everyone. It is a pleasure to bring you Tuesday Night Talmud, late spring edition, featuring what's going on at this time in life. Things are reopening here in the United States. The OU has a drive going for India, because global equity is crucial, both from self-serving perspectives in a pandemic, like we don't actually eliminate the pandemic in the world economy, which we are a part of, will still collapse, and also it's the right thing to do. So I'm just going to remind people that the Orthodox Union has a drive going. 100% of the proceeds go to much needed medical equipment on the ground in India. So I'm putting that out there. And it's a pleasure to say the Mets are in first place.
That I know, astonishing.
So I'm in an apparently jovial mood for that reason. And trivial as it may be, let us jump in. Okay. So we started actually with a, sometimes it's good to do things again and again. The Rav Soloveitchik used to teach Talmud, and they say about him that he would regularly teach, okay. He would regularly teach the same sugya as if it was brand new, even though he had taught it a million times before, even though he had taught it yesterday, he had this ability to learn it fresh and not have the conclusions of yesterday bias the conclusions of, I'm talking about Rav Soloveitchik. So, they learned it one way yesterday, but maybe today a different shot, a different meaning is emerging. So in that spirit, I think it's a good habit, though, to be looking at things not with, oh, this is how it is, but how could it be? So, Tanya Rabbi Lezer HaKaparomer, does everyone see where we are? On 29A?
Yep.
Tanya Rabbi Lezer HaKaparomer. So tonight's agenda, we're going to start with a teaching really about Har Sinai. You almost wish we got to this just before Shavuos, but we just missed it. And then, I don't know how I let that happen. And then we're going to go to a teaching about whether you can make a shul a kapendria, a shortcut. And we're going to discuss a little bit about how the shuls might have looked and what they were talking about and what that means for our purposes. Maybe, depending on how into it we'll get to the next Mishnah. After this, coming up, kind of the concluding class, this will be about the Torah readings. Which Torah reading do we read what week, and how did that all happen? Which is pretty essential. It's a surprise here in this section dealing with shuls, but we're now in, like, once you're at shuls, stuff you do in shuls, like read the Torah. I know prayer was in brachot. You might have expected the Torah reading to be in brachot, but it's here. Okay. Tanya Rabbi Lezer HaKaparomer. Asidin bate knesias uvate midrasos shebevavel shikavu be'eretz Yisrael shene amarki kesavor beharim uchecharmel bayam yavo. So they taught, Rabbi Lezer HaKaparomer taught the following teaching. In the future, presumably the messianic future, the shuls and the study halls of Babylonia, query, do we mean anywhere in the diaspora, or are we just talking about Babylonia? Probably we mean the whole diaspora. Sheikh Avu the Eretz Israel, they will be reestablished. The idea seemed to be they're going to, like, you see Rashi, for example. We'll see this in a minute. They're going to, like, fly to Israel. The shuls are going to fly to Israel. Now, I just want to note that this teaching seems to be in some contrast to the rule we learned, which is Batei Knessios Shebevavel Altanaihim Umdim. Synagogues in Babylonia, you may recall we learned, are always built on condition. And just to review, we had two understandings of what it means that synagogues in Babylonia are conditional. One understanding, the Tosafos, this is not the main understanding, was that it so happened that when they built synagogues in Babylonia, that is, you know, Iraq, which is to say where the major Talmudic academies were, they always built those synagogues with a condition. What do we mean a condition? When the board or whoever it was commissioned the building of a synagogue, they passed a resolution, you know, according to Robert's Rules of Orders in all likelihood, that said, do we have a motion? Do we have a second? Okay, let's have discussion. And someone said, let us condition the building of the synagogue such that if we want to sell it in the future for any reason, we can. That's the story Tosafos tells. So that was the custom of how they did things in Babylonia. Other Mefarshim, all the other Mefarshim, tell a very different story, which is that when it says that synagogues in Babylonia were built conditionally, it doesn't mean in Babylonia they happened to make a condition. And what is the condition, by the way? The condition is that you can sell it, or that it doesn't have permanent Kedusha. The holiness, the sanctity, can go away. The other understanding was no. And this is how we rule halachically in all of the codes, that synagogues in the exile, Lav Davka, not specifically Babylonia, but in all of the exile, are automatically built with an implicit condition that they can be sold, ostensibly. And we fret sometimes about why or who, because of how it looks. Basically, the rabbis were concerned with how it looks. But as a fundamental matter, you're allowed to sell them. The question is just to what and to who and under what conditions. And why? Because in the end, we're all going to go to Israel. The Messiah will come. I think Israel might even have a coalition government, including left-wing Jewish socialists, an Arab Islamist party, and right-wing Jewish parties. Maybe is that the Messiah? I don't know if that's the Messiah. It sounds close to it. So in the end, we'll all go there. And since we'll all go there, we're going to have to a bit, you know, in other words, unfortunately, it's not just the small and medium shuls in the exile. Even the huge synagogues are going to be abandoned in the Messianic era if we're all in the Holy Land or something like that. So it can't, it must be that there can, so both of those understandings of that teaching are in conflict with this teaching, right? Because this teaching says, actually, you know, I'd always heard this about bodies, that Jewish bodies are going to like roll underground to Eretz Yisrael. Anyone ever hear that? Some version of that?
Yep.
Right? Did anyone ever hear it about like the shul? The shul is going to fly to Israel?
No.
Right? That's, I think, a new one. Dr. Mandelbaum, you're on mute. Oh, okay. Yeah, so.
Can I ask a question? Does this only apply to shuls outside Israel?
Yes. So, you know, this is an interesting, there's an interesting debate. The condition piece or the flying away?
The condition piece.
Yeah. So there's an interesting question. What about in Israel? Because the truth is, in Israel, you know, here at least we have some outs, right? Which is that a lot of them, the authorities say you can sell it because in the end, one day, nothing lasts forever in the exile. But in Jerusalem, you know, what if your building falls into disrepair and you want to exchange it for a more modern one because it's too costly? What do you do if you're the synagogue board? You know, you're the same eventualities and realities occur. They're kind of, you know, so there's a debate. Can you make a condition there or not, you know? And so some authorities say you can't make a condition in Israel, whereas others say you can, it's just not automatic, right? In other words, you know, I think most synagogue boards or governing bodies of these places aren't necessarily, they haven't learned this chapter of Talmud in detail to know that they should be considering a list of kind of exceptions when they build a synagogue. But many authorities do permit a condition in Israel. Some do not. Because fundamentally, it shouldn't be holier there. You know what I'm saying? In other words, you'd have to say, I'm always interested in trying to work out the lumdus. What would it be to say what you're saying? So you could say something, and people have said something like this. Well, look, synagogues in Babylonia, because of the fact that they're temporary and there's this implicit condition, the level of sanctity that's there in the first place is an order lower, which is not as holy because they're temporary. And synagogues in Israel, because they're in Israel, are automatically an order higher, such that you can't make a condition. But I think that that's not as supported in terms of lamdas. I'm not saying halachic codes and who ruled what, but in terms of the theory, you know, we have a rule that after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, that the Mikdash Ma'at, the little temple, is the shul. And so once the little temple is the shul, what does it matter if the little temple is in Ashkelon or in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem or in Providence? It's Mikdash Me'at, you know? The question is, here in Providence, we know one day, you know, it's less likely to last forever than a shul in Jerusalem. But of course, plenty of Jewish synagogues in Israel, in the land of Israel, have been abandoned, destroyed, or sold in their time, right? And the truth of the matter is, and I'll just end on this note for this piece, so long as there's any lenient opinion that says you can make a condition, and maybe you can sell it, whatever shul is going to need to sell their building, wherever, is going to do that one. In other words, they're going to seek out that rabbinic opinion because they need to sell the building. So, all right, little real
so can I, sorry, can I just ask one more question? And is there a difference between Jerusalem and the rest of Israel?
Good question. What about Jerusalem and the rest of Israel? You know, Jerusalem might be a little different too, because there's a question, actually in a different place in the Gemara Megillah, other places, was Yerushalayim Nitchal Kala Shvatim or not? When they made the division in the times of Yeshua ben Nun of the land, you know, they took a certain amount of time to conquer the land for the kibush, and then they took another, the same amount of time, 12 years is it, to divide the land and distribute it to the tribes in the book of Joshua. And the rules of that, we have the Talmud or Halacha L'Moshe Misina, or were passed down, whatever. But there's an oral tradition about the division of the land. So there's a debate. Was Jerusalem allotted to tribes, to any of the tribes? Or is it like Washington, D.C. or Abuja, Nigeria? That is federal property. It's really the same question as D.C. statehood. Just the religious version of it, if you're trying to think about it, right? Some people are arguing now that Washington, D.C. has people living in it, should have electors, just like every other place. Why should its residents be disenfranchised? But I would imagine the framers considered it a kind of federal republic city of some sort, not really a member of any of the polity states that comprise the union. And there are other federalist capitals of countries. Abuja, Nigeria is one I'm thinking of. It's not really a member of any other state. Just because I've been there is what I'm thinking of that, but maybe people can think of others. So the general ruling is that Jerusalem was not divided. You know, it's a debate in the Talmud, but we kind of assume Jerusalem wasn't divided among the Shvatim. So there's essentially no private land ownership in Jerusalem. So if it wasn't divided to the Shvatim, what follows from that is that no one really owns the land. It's like the Federal Republic of God. It's, you know, it's funny because people fight a lot about Jerusalem, but actually the Jewish conception of what the city is kind of God's city, isn't entirely consistent with that idea. So really, you know, maybe you can rent out your thing. There's, you know, ramifications of this, like in the Talmud Yerushalmi Shkalim, it talks about how when people would come to the temple, you know, the innkeepers in Jerusalem weren't allowed to charge them like a hotel's fare, because they don't own the property, who are they, and things like that. You know, how we do it today, we could discuss, you know. But therefore, why am I bringing this up? Because you asked, is Jerusalem the same? So Jerusalem, notions of property in Jerusalem are entirely different. So it's entirely possible that, just like there's no private ownership of land in Jerusalem in Jewish law, so there's probably no corporate ownership of land, at least in the old city of Jerusalem, in Jewish law. And therefore, a board really couldn't say we own this shul. and therefore we can sell this shul or something like that. I think it would be even harder than a different, it's already hard because maybe it's not on condition and maybe you can't do it and it's in Israel, but now you have the added thing of who says you can own anything in Jerusalem altogether. Forget a synagogue. Can you sell your house? So the point answer is not really. So Jerusalem is more complicated in that way.
Okay.
But not because the temple is there, but because it wasn't divided and apportioned among the tribes, I would say, conceptually. That's a tentative answer. I want to research and make sure I'm not misstating anything. Any questions about that?
No. Just in terms of conditions, it would be different.
It would, yeah. Jerusalem would be different. While we're talking, I will encourage people to visit the Ramban Synagogue in the old city of Yerushalayim, destroyed and rebuilt repeatedly, but currently rebuilt since its rededication in 2007, I want to say. A wonderful, beautiful synagogue that is quite old. Okay, it wasn't a synagogue for a long time, and now it is again. So some of these synagogues in that area kind of have like cats, which there are many there too. They have many lives. Right. So Bar Kappara taught, in the end of days, these shuls and study halls. So it's interesting, right? He's including the study halls. You might not have thought, the Judaica library goes too, but it does, are going to fly to Israel. As it says, where does it say that? In Jeremiah. Ki ketavor beharim uchecharmel bayam yavo. So Jeremiah says, like Tabor among the mountains, like Carmel by the sea, so shall he come. Talking about what in context? Let's always see the context. You see the context? So, Ha'ani ne'um ha'melech Hashem tzvakot shemo ki ketavor ba'arim u'chacharmel bayam yavo. Klei gola asilach yoshevet bat mitzrayim ki nof l'shama tihyeh v'nitzita me'in yoshev. Translate, I'll read from here. As I live, declares the king, whose name is Lord of hosts. That's God, in case you're not clear. As surely as Tabor is among the mountains, and Carmel is by the sea, so shall this happen, Yavo. Klei gola asilach. Get ready for exile, Yoshevet bat Mitzrayim, inhabitants of Egypt, or here as they translate it, fair Egypt. Kinov l'shama tihyeh, for Nov shall become a waste, v'nitzdame in Yoshev, desolate without inhabitants. I was talking about this messianic future, right? That we will return from exile and Egypt will go into exile. You know, this idea of like the nations will be exiled and we will be redeemed. Everything will flip. So you immediately see from the context of this verse that this is a prophecy in Jeremiah about what? About return, right? In most of the destructions, but this is like in a deeper future. And so you see why they're talking about a messianic future from this pasuk. Now, Har Tavor, let's just go with the metaphor here. Has anyone been to Har Tavor, Mount Tabor, or Har Carmel? Both have wineries. Okay,
been a while.
Mount Carmel is near Haifa, kind of by the sea, and Har Tavor is further inland. So what tradition are they referring to? It's a kavachomer. It's an A40RE argument. Ma Tavor v'Charmel shelo bala l'pisha l'mil Torah nikbim b'Eretz Yisrael. Here's the rule. Mount, oh, Peter Berman here. Mount Tabor, Har Tabor and Har Carmel, they came to learn Torah from Mount Sinai, and insisted, they're kind of referring to a tradition that's not fully stated here, that they are real mountains and Mount Sinai is a fake mountain. You may be familiar with the idea that Mount Sinai is the humblest of the mountains, small and significant. No one knows where it is. History Channel specials fight about it. But and so here they have these other real mountains like Har Tabor and Har Carmel. Both have good hikes and good wineries, I should mention. They come to Mount Sinai and they say, like, we should get the Torah. We're real mountains. You are a fake mountain. And they, which came to study Torah, it's a funny way of citing this tradition. They came to study Torah. They wanted to be the one that got the Torah, right? But they're there. You know what I'm saying? So for the wrong reason, they came to Matan Torah. But they came. They came for the kavod or for the steak dinner. They are those mountains. They came for all the wrong reasons. But still, they came. So because of that, they get transported to Eretz Yisrael and affixed there because, look, they wanted to learn Torah. So shuls and study halls, a base medrash where people study Torah for the right reasons, of course, always. Isn't it all the more so that they should be relocated to Israel? Anyone following that?
Yeah, I'm following it. It just doesn't seem likely. I mean, practically.
Right. So clearly they didn't actually.
No. It's a metaphor, I presume.
Now we have the commentary of the Ben Yoyada, the Ben Yishchai. I don't actually know what this says, but I see in Sfar that it's here. And so whenever a Sephardic Kabbalist has comments to make about Agadata, legendary material in the Talmud, I feel as though it's worth the exploration. So will you permit us a digression to see what it says?
Okay.
Everyone? Ein HaKavana, and people can start thinking about Ruth's question, which is like, obviously, do we really believe the mountains were like elsewhere?
Yeah.
They got up and came to Sinai and then they wound up in Israel. Like, what, are we just playing, what's going on here? Are we real? Are we being serious? So Ben Yoyad explains about the idea that in the future, shuls are going to fly to Israel. We're not saying that the real estate, the actual land, you know, there's the land and then there's the edifice, or like real estate property, I got it to here. I'm not saying the land is going to uproot and reestablish in Israel. It's not like Mount Tabor and Carmel, like the physical land that was Tabor and Carmel got up and went to Mount Sinai. Ella, this is answering your question, isn't it? But rather, Akabanahu Kamoshi Ishla Gufa Adam Seol Ruchani Shemakifo. No, everyone has a spiritual shadow, says the Ben Yoyada. Yeah, think of, well, Peter Pan comes to mind, but think of what you will. Everyone has, you can be more serious than that. Everyone has their physical body, but there's also the spiritual you and that surrounds you. Shaguf Moshe Chiyut Mimenu. The body draws life force from the spiritual soul. Kenish Tzeil Shehu Avir Zach Ruchani Chofev Ala Aretz Kula Umeir La. So to the ground has a spiritually refined atmosphere, for lack of a better word, Chofev Ala Aretz, that hovers over the land. The land is animated, says the Benish. It's got a spirit. Umeirla, and it brings light. It enlightens the land. So Shavet, Bizchuto, Malato. And not every piece of land has the same merit, the same level. There are many different levels of spiritual shadow that live in the non-Israel land. I bet you had no idea you were coming here tonight. You know, what makes Israel so special, he says, isn't the dysfunctional politics. You get that anywhere. It's the spiritual life force of the land. Vilachim, Amru Rabutin, the rabbis taught. Apasuk ha'aretz asher ata shochev aleha lecha et nena ulizarecha. God says to Avram, I think. The land that you are sleeping on, I will give to your descendants. Shekipel HaKadosh Baruch Hu HaKos Shavinichat Tachtav Sheyakov. Oh, it's Yaakov in his dream. Okay. God folded all of the land underneath the stone pillow of Yaakov. And so when he slept, it was like a kinyan, an acquisition. And he slept on all the land. What about all the people in the rest of the land? Where'd they go when the land folded over itself and all came under Yaakov's stone pillow? How'd that work? He asks. What about the animals? The buildings, personal property. Where'd they go? What about people's pots and houses? Talking about the spirit of all the land came there. Just like the soul gives sustenance to the body. Like this, writes Rabbi Yishai Levi Aretz, who knew we would quote my wife's family? Who knew? I honestly had no idea any of this was coming. But the Shla, the great mystic of Prague and then Jerusalem, wrote, wherever Jews are, you get a little bit of Israel atmosphere or aura surrounding them on their land. And there it is permissible to offer sacrifices to God. After all, how did the Israelites offer sacrifices in the desert for 40 years? It's not the sanctity of Israel. Answer is, but the encampment was there. We're reading by Midbar now. And even though they were kvetching the whole time, but still, they brought with them some of that Israelite holiness. And so it's like mini Israel traveling. Okay. So in any event, he wants to say that this whole idea that mountains went is the mountain souls. And when we say that the shuls are going to go to Israel, we don't really mean the physical shuls. He doesn't even sound like he means the edifice. It means every shul and every base medrash has a spirit that lives on. And that spirit, in the end of days, will make aliyah and reestablish itself in Israel. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean like, you know, there's like the Mir Yeshiva. And it's called the Mir Yeshiva, though it's in a different building on different land. One day, will there be congregation Beth Shalom? And people ask, where will our final home be? And the answer is somewhere in the land of Israel. That's what it sounds like. You follow? Now, what I don't know is...
It does raise a question in terms of everything we were discussing for quite a while. If the shul is defined by the spirit of the people, then the whole issue of selling it, you know, it's sort of, you know, the whole... Gemara, you can't sell the building. You can't sell the building. If it's the people and not the building, then it changes the calculus on all that other.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what the Ben Yishai is saying here. And if we just delve into it a little, right? At first, he was saying every physical land has its own kala arat sod, right? Every land has its own character. And I would agree with that characterization, right? In other words, New England is not Israel. But it has a real special character that's associated with the land. My friends in the field of, you know, geo everything, right? There's everything now, geopolitics, geo, you can mix geography with every discipline, architecture, and the relationship between architecture and the land. I've seen it all. So here we kind of have geo-spirituality. There's a spirituality to each piece of land, and it's different. And it's not just about the physical essence of the land.
That's very interesting, because it is true that New England gives birth to a certain type of religious knowledge, you know, the thing that Unitarians believe in, the brotherhood of man and the neighborhood of Boston, you know, the old line. But there is real truth to that in New England.
Yeah, and you know, from what I understand in history, it seems like there was a moment in like northern Germany, you know, where there was this kind of, everyone was rolling around in ice and whipping each other and burning each other and repenting like it was the end of times, you know, Christians and Jews alike in their own ways. But, you know, you wonder to what extent that relates to, you know, was it not just the cultural diffusion amongst the peoples, but, you know, is there something beyond, you know, rational explanation going on about the spirit of the place?
A place that has mountains and storms probably creates a religious sensitivity different than the desert does.
Right. You know, and to what it would be interesting then to really get into this and think about to what extent are, like, you know, is Bedouin religion similar to Southwest Native Americans, and what ways are not, you know, to places in kind of similar terrains and atmospheres. All of this is a little blurred here in the teaching, because his first statement is like every land has its own spirituality, but then he quotes the Shlaz saying that the reason the people could sacrifice sacrifices in the desert for 40 years is because they brought with them some of that Israel atmosphere, because they were Jews. And so, you know, is he saying that we can have a shul here because we make it a little bit of Israel because we're Jews? Or is he saying that the shul will go to Israel because we'll go to Israel? And when we go to Israel, we'll bring, you know, some of that our shul. And so is it really about the people, like the Shlaz is saying, or is it about the place? And even maybe the building itself, like the Ben Yoyada seems to be intimating. Ben Yoyada is the commentary of the Ben Yishrei on the Agadat, the legendary material. This idea is a really interesting one. I do think it is a little comforting amidst some change to think that, you know, Shari Tzedek is gone as the shul, but it's not just like we say Yizkor and mention it in Yizkor, you know, on Shari Tzedek, like it's some, you know, we have their plaques. It's like part of our spiritual heritage. All right, anyway, I'm glad we took this diversion on that teaching. I'd never heard that idea before. Had anyone in that way? It's a new idea to me. Okay, I wanted to say something. I don't know what. Well, I'll move on. I have something insightful to say for once. It's gone. Daj Bar Kapara. So, Bar Kapara taught. Did anyone have any questions or comments about that? It's a very rich teaching. So I just want, oh, I wanted to talk about, you know, do you all remember Rabbi David Horowitz, Rabbi Dr. David Horowitz from Yeshiva University, presented here? Used to come sometimes for a day of learning that used to happen in memory of
Dr. Gottlieb.
Dr. Gottlieb, yes. I couldn't remember if it was Dr. Zuckerman or Dr. Gottlieb.
Or both, and, maybe.
Or both. And one of the years he spoke about the Ralph Hogg's theory of Israel and climate. Does anyone remember this? And he quoted the theory of Gersonides, which I was unfamiliar with to date, that Israel was selected for the Jews because it had the perfect climate for prophecy and spiritual inquiry, but particularly prophecy. And it was because it had a little bit of everything. It had desert and it had mountain. It had coastline and it had valley. It had storminess and it had lots of dry heat and chamsan. It had some snow. And it had a little bit of all the things. And so in order to have real prophecy, you need to be fully... it had earthquakes. You need to be fully... I don't think there are any volcanoes, so far as I know. You need to be fully... kind of what you're saying, Peter, but this is a climate-based theory of it. You really need for prophecy to have the full experience of the range of human weather conditions. And only Israel has it in such a small space, which is why it was selected as the home for the Jews, its climate. And the relationship to the variety of weather made it the perfect home. So
probably Rhode Island just missed out.
Rhode Island had deserts.
I mean, it might have squeezed out Israel. It's a smaller place that has almost.
And certainly New England writ large is, you know, not far off in that way. And we have nor'easters, you know, we have big snowstorms, which they don't quite have in that way. And anyway, so I just feel like it's worth referencing. You know, I don't remember the details, but that's, I think, the summary of the presentation. Does anyone remember that? Many of you were there. Anyway, that was the presentation that was given. Darsh Bar Kappara, Maidachtiv Lama Teratz Dun. It was memorable to me. Lama Teratz Dun Harim Gav Nunim. So the verse says, and we're still on this teaching about Mount Sinai, Lama Teratz Dun Harim Gav Nunim. Why do you look askance, O high peaked mountains? Now, Yatzta Bat Kova Amra Lahem, Lama Tirtzu Dinim Sinai, Kochem Valemunim Atem Yitzel Sinai. So now back to this idea that the mountains are upset with Mount Sinai. We have a verse in Psalms. Why do you look askance? Harim Gav Nunim. Gav Nunim is a weird word. Seems to be from Gibain. Gibain is one of the mumim, one of the invalidations mentioned last week of the Kohanim. You can't serve if you're a Gibain. We said maybe it was like a hunchback, the conclusion we came to. In any event, it has to do with that. So God says, why do you want to fight with Mount Sinai? Really, why Lama Tirtzu Din? Why do you want a lawsuit against Mount Sinai? I like to make this modern language. So they want to sue Mount Sinai for getting the Torah. I don't know what is the lawsuit here, tortious interference. They were going to get the Torah, but Mount Sinai got it. I don't know what the claim is. They're upset with Sinai and they're taking it to court. So God says, or Batkul says, what are you doing suing Sinai? You're all invalid compared to, you're all worse than Sinai. You're not worthy. It's written here, Gav Nunim, high mountains, and it's written there, Gibain Odak, two things that invalidate a Kohen. One of them seems to be a hunchback. You're a bunch of hunchbacks. You're pathetic, says God. Amarav Ashish Mamina, Aimandia here, Bamun. So you see what the issue is. We would have thought that the mountains, those mountains are beautiful mountains. Carmel, Tavor, the ones mentioned before. Mount Sinai is like a fake mountain. It's like a hill, basically. So, and they're going to Sinai and think, what are you? You're a mountain? You're not a mountain. And God says back, oh yeah, you think you're so hot? You know what? You are arrogant, big snow-capped mountains, rocky Everest. You think you're mountains? You are Bali Gaifa. And so you don't deserve the Torah. Now, what's really interesting about this teaching is the subversive nature of it. The pasuk in the Torah that is quoted, that a Kohen who's a hunchback or maybe is a dwarf can't serve, is related to their own physical deformity. A Kohen who is physically deformed can't serve. It's related to the aesthetic quality of the Kohen. The Kohen has to have a certain level of attractiveness. But or can't have a certain level of repulsiveness. But the mountains, when they claim that they are attractive, God flips it and says, oh yeah, you think you're attractive? You're also arrogant. And so it kind of flips the meaning, you follow? The Torah seems to think a Kohen ought to have an aesthetic quality to it. But Mount Sinai is the opposite. The fact that it doesn't have the aesthetic quality actually contributes to the humility, which is part of the reason it merits having the Torah given. In Osinato Compendria, my Compendria, Amarava Compendria, Kishma, my Kishma, Kamada Amram Adamakefna Adare Eubaha. So you can't make, we're done with that teaching. Sorry, Peter, you were here last week, weren't you?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
I believe I was not.
Oh, you were not. Okay, I want to make sure I'm not repeating material. Last week, I think I had four different people. So I'm doing the same material, but I want to make sure no one's bored. So in Osinoto Compendria, you can't make your shul a compendria. What's a make a compendria out of your shul? What's a compendria? My compendria, asked the Gemara. What's that? Amarava compendria kishma. Like it sounds like. Like it sounds like what? My kishma. What does that mean? Kamanta Amar. This is a language issue. Like the rabbi said, you can't do this. And everyone's like, what does that mean? It's like, it means what it says. We don't know what that means. Okay. Adimakifna adare e ubaha. So let's just follow this. Adimakifna adare. Until you makifna, like hakafa, until you go around adare, the houses, the darim, until you go around the houses. Kapendria, adimakifna adaria, until you go around the houses. In other words, e ubaha, I'll enter it. In other words, instead of going around the block, I'll walk through the shul. Otherwise known as a shortcut, or in more formal language, an easement across the property. You can't just go through the shul as a rite of passage in order to get to the other side to save yourself time. Amar Rebbe Abahu, im hayashvil meikara mutar. If there was initially a path or like a road there, and they built the shul on top of it, it is permissible to continue to use the path even though there's shul. So first I'll ask you why, maybe we need to understand, what's the source of this prohibition? Anyone? Like why can't, you? In order to understand this, we need to understand the root cause here. Why can't you go take a shortcut through the shul? And furthermore, are we talking about the entire shul building? If you've got, you know, synagogue, city block, let's just call it, and it's got a city, and they have the social hall and the second social hall and the janitor's quarters and the offices and the classrooms and the religious school and the mikveh, you can't take a shortcut through any of it, or just the sanctuary. And what's the reasoning behind all of this? And in order to help understand that, maybe Rebbe Abahu's easement exception is worth bearing in mind, that if there was originally a public path there, then you can continue to use it as a shortcut. That's a weird exception.
Other than that, it's sort of grandfather.
Right, it's a grandfather clause.
Because it was there before the show.
Yeah. Ruth, were you going to come up with a theory of this all?
Well, I don't know. Is it obvious that, is it too obvious to say that the space was holy or sacred or whatever, right? But,
so, yeah.
I don't know.
So, the Rambam helps us a little bit. The Rambam, when he codifies this law, I brought it up on your screen. Sorry, it's funny like this. The one thing I will miss about in person, I'm not going to miss when we go back to doing this in person, but the ability to just throw a source in front of all your eyes simultaneously is fun. The Rambam, and it's funny, this is in Hilchot Tefillah of all places, and Birkat Kohanim, Hayal Veta Kenasa Til Veta Midrash. If you're in a shul or a base medrash, notice the Rambam expands in Osin Oso Compendria. He's changed Oso, Oto, to Otam. And he's saying it about a Beit Knesset or a Beit Midrash. So it's not just about a shul in the Rambam, although it's not clear where, you know, the Gemara we've discussed what's holier, but you might have thought this just applied to a shul. The Rambam is immediately understanding it applies to Beit Knesset Ola Beit HaMidrash, which is not explicit in this teaching in the Gemara. Shnei Ptachim, if they have two doors in the shul, Lo Ya'asenu Kapendri. Now, it's interesting if it has two doors. If it has one door, I guess it's impossible. In other words, you have to go in where you go out because there's only one door. Why? Maybe someone can help me here. I've been wondering. Does the Rambam, in other words, obviously, if there's only one door to the thing, I can't make a shortcut out of it because, I mean, there's only one way in and out. So why does the Rambam feel the need to say if there are at least two doors? You know, is that not obvious? What's he adding here? Don't make it a shortcut. Kadeshi kanet bepetach sevi, it's a bepetach shekinegdo the karev aderach. Means to say you enter one door and you leave on the door opposite in order to shorten your way. Shasur bikanes ban elidvar mitzvah. Because it is, so here's the Rambam statement of the reason, in case it is prohibited to enter a shul except for a mitzvah. You can only enter a shul except, as they translate here, to fulfill a religious duty. So for the Rambam, you know, you might have thought, right, it's about the look of it. If I make a shortcut out of the shul, it looks like I'm disrespecting the shul. But for the Rambam, importantly, it's not about Maris Ayin. And maybe we know this from the grandfather clause. The fact that a prior public bath is grandfathered in shows us that it's not about, you know, how they're going to judge you or respect for the place. It's really a formal prohibition. You shouldn't enter a shul except to do a mitzvah. And you shouldn't enter a base medrash except to do a mitzvah, you know, not to get it, grab a cup of coffee or to talk. Now, from that language, it sounds like then it's just talking about the actual sanctuary or study hall, which has some kind of kedusha, but not, you know, it's not prohibited, I wouldn't think, to enter a shul building to stop by the office or to, you know, paint the wall. I mean, you can do whatever you want in a shul building. It's the sanctuary which has this status. So sounds like that's what we're talking about. It is worth noting here, and I'm going to lean on Mike Forstad if he's with us to correct me if I'm wrong. You're our resident anthropologist. Yes, that's you. I see you've unmuted. Yeah, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the old shuls in much of the ancient world, and query how long they were like this, were kind of like this. This is my arc. That's my Torah. You get the idea, yeah. Okay, that's pretty bad. Okay, fine. So my sense as what shuls in ancient Israel looked like from a bunch of college courses I've taken. I used to take college courses in this stuff. Is that they look kind of like the Toro synagogue, but without the New England style to it. These are pillars, beams. There's a name for them, internal beams that hold up the wall, right? And along the outside are like maybe benches. And in here, maybe there's a Torah reading table. Yeah. You all kind of follow that? So the way, whatever. Yeah, you get, I'm not an artist, but do people understand what I'm saying? The way the shul worked is that people would enter through this door and they would sit along the benches on the outside. And the action, Torah reading, prayer leading, happened here. They were kind of all spectators, and maybe there was a balcony for women above. I think the Toro synagogue design, by the way, if people can picture that, can people picture that in their minds? Has anyone been there recently enough? More or less maintains this kind of feature of kind of seating along the perimeter with the action happening in a, you know, largely empty middle. And maybe there was an exit, you know, over here or over here. And so you could kind of come in and go out. So in this kind of design, which was classic of ancient Israelite synagogues, at least after the Second Temple period, you know, during the Second Temple period, they were just in-ground amphitheaters, right? Like at Masada or places like that. I think people are familiar with the kind of ditch with a cute couple of rows of stadium seating is the synagogue. but when they were edifices, which, by the way, may correspond to the rise of churches and Christianity, query whether this is a religious competition gone capitalist, you know. But when shuls become like this, all there is the shul. There's not, you know, the so-and-so education wing. There's just the shul. So I think that's probably what they're dealing with. Yeah. Is just the shul. It's not a synagogue building with a sanctuary inside with many other rooms. So I think that it sounds like from the Talmud there, you know, we know that this is what synagogues look like in the Talmudic period. It sounds like this is what we're working with. So I just wanted to share that because I think that is correct. Mike, I don't know if you know anything about this, but does this sound fair?
Well, I was a prehistoric archaeologist, but just in terms of the idea of it just being a single room, just, I don't know exactly how it was set up inside, but it just being a single room dwelling or structure is right. Yeah, there wasn't. There weren't complex buildings. They were just single room structures. You know?
Right. Okay. Cool. Good. That is the confirmation that yes.
Yeah.
So my sense is that there was actually a fairly uniform design on the inside, actually, even across geography, from what they found. And this is kind of what we're dealing with. So therefore, all these halachot, you know, kind of are in that context. Okay, I'll just do one more thing so we can finish.
Can I ask a quick question? Sorry. So no. this is to say that this would apply if it's a more permanent shul structure, meaning not something that's makeshift, that's, you know, remember the first classes, they were having shuls, prayer spaces in marketplaces.
Right. You know, what about the city streets?
Yeah, so this is really, if the place has been dedicated to be a sanctuary, then don't run in and out. But if it's makeshift, I'm assuming that it's only permanent for the time that there's prayer happening at that point.
That's right. And, you know, the Aruch HaShulchan asked the question, what if you rent a room that's used for other things, for a minyan? Which is relevant for, say, Congregation Bat Shalom right now, or Congregation Shai Tfila, for that matter. Two congregations. Theirs is a lunchroom and sometimes a gym, and ours is a social hall. Sometimes there are speakers, sometimes wedding banquets. But even before that, we used to have this idea in Congregation Bat Shalom that we had, for example, Judge, gosh, someone help me, the Toro Synagogue case, the federal judge. It's only one.
Yeah. He's now the Chief Justice.
Yeah.
Irish name.
Mick.
Conley, but that isn't it. Something like that. The one who decided in favor of Rhode Island.
Yeah. Gosh. Okay. I have a case in the federal courts now. I hope he's not listening. Okay. So, any event. Right. We had a judge. So, what do we need to do to make people happy? We got to close the Aron and lock it. You know, that not just the curtain. There was this sense, and maybe we should take down the mechitzas. People had an informal sense, but this is true in many synagogues, that you can turn the shul space into a multi-purpose room that's suitable for not bad purposes, just not mitzvah purposes. You know, a lecture about a lawsuit isn't a mitzvah. It's interesting. It's fine. It's appropriate for a synagogue to host, but it's not shul appropriate. You know, like sanctuary. So there is this kind of widespread idea, I think, that if you just kind of lock up the doors and put the stuff away, that somehow it's not a shul for the moment. I think that's implicit in American synagogues. There's almost like a tenai that even in a permanent sanctuary, you might use it if the space requires for other needs and kind of treat it temporarily as a non-sanctuary. You could make such a condition, by the way, and you can make it more permanent than that. You could say, this will be a shul while we pray in it. But while we don't pray in it, it will be a multi-purpose room. The Orthodox community of Penn did that on Shabbos. We used a social hall in Hillel to pray. It was a social hall. We wheeled in an aron. It was beautiful prayer, but it was totally makeshift. So there were all kinds of non-appropriate things. I don't even think about it. That happened in that space that were not shul appropriate, right? Similar idea. Yes, Ruth. So this seems to be talking about either a shul while it's functioning as a shul or something that is clearly permanently designed as a sanctuary. You know, no one would suggest that the sanctuary in Toro Synagogue could ever be anything but, except maybe it's a historic site too, because people go on tours there probably more than they pray there. But
and they have the Washington letter reading lecture every year, which is not a religion.
Maybe it does actually double as like historic site. In fact, it's on the National Historic Register, and presidents and chief justices and whatnot come there. So it seems
as
like
did George Washington. I mean, that's what started. Right.
So maybe I take it back. The Torah Synagogue is both a sanctuary and a historic kind of tourist site, frankly, and history site. So shuls can have these other functions. So they must be talking about something that is a sanctuary in a very permanent way or at that time. Amar of Nachum Bar Yitzchak, HaNichnas HaManashalun, Nasos Kamacha Mutra Lasos HaKapendria. Now, if you enter, we'll end with this teaching, not to make it a shortcut, but you daven there. Do you have to go out the long way? Or can you take a shortcut on the way out? You know, if you can leave this exit and it'll be, you know, a block closer, can you do it? So he says, yeah, as long as you didn't go in to do that, you went in for the right reasons. Now, it's ambiguous. Do you actually have to have prayed? Can you go in to pray, realize that you already prayed, you forgot, you caught a minion earlier, and continue on your way with the shortcut because you entered? It sounds like maybe. The point is, as long as you enter lawfully, there's no Maris Ayin issue. Right? This may be where the Rama, we may be teasing out, is it a problem of how it looks? And the answer is no. For Amar Rabbi Chelbo, you must take a shortcut. Amar Rabbi Chelbo. Not just you can, you should. I'm a Rav Huna, Hanichnas Abis Knesses is Paul Mutra Lasosa Compendria. He says it's Mutra. We'll get to a different gear in a minute. Shanem or Bivo, I'm a arts of Neashem Bemuadim, Abad Derashat Safon, Ishtach Bosietzi Derashat Negev. It says in Ezekiel that in the Messianic future, when the people of Israel come before God on the festivals to the temple, they will enter the northern gate. What's the northern gate of the Temple Mount? From like, you know, where the Arab quarter meets the like near Mount Scope, like that area, right? The northern, you have to go through the Arab quarter to get to the northern gate. Yeah. Any event, you go through the northern gate to the temple and you'll leave the southern gate. The southern gate was where there's an archaeological dig now, the Davidson Archaeological Park. Anyone who's never been there? I once got locked there, imprisoned by Glenn Beck's personal security team. It's a story I think I've told. I'll save it for another time, maybe. But Glenn Beck was leading a, you know, Christian evangelical, we love Israel rally. And Naomi and I were on our honeymoon. And we were, I'll end with the story, maybe. In the southern, near the southern gate there. It's where the Levim sang in the choir. And we missed the memo that they were closing early for this big Glenn Beck, We Love Israel solidarity event. And he was going to do it from this archaeological park, from the steps where the Levites sang, from the very steps. And his personal security team, I guess, flagged us. It's like, what are we doing around here? And they detained us for the rest of the entire day. It was like 2 p.m. until the evening. And we called the Israeli police who got in a fight with the personal security team. Eventually we were freed hours later. We're held at gunpoint. It was traumatic. And I later called into the Glenn Beck show to complain about this treatment. And he featured us briefly on the show. Okay. Anyway, that's the story. But so the Southern Gate, this is my experience with the Southern Gate. So what's the point? The verse in Ezekiel says, you come in the northern gate, you leave the southern gate. Now, here it says, mutar, you're allowed, because look what they did in the temple. They came in one entrance, they left the other. But some gear says, the Rif has this, say, mitzvah lasos or compendria. It's a mitzvah. You're supposed to go in the shul one way and leave the other, because look what they'll do in the temple. Why would it be either permissible or good to make a shortcut? The answer, according to the post scheme that deal with it, like the Ivitz says, it's Ravinus Medschitz, that just like Abraham traversed the whole land, or Jacob, the land folded under him, like we read before, you know, so by going in one entrance to the shul and out the other, you're kind of walking through the whole shul. And it's like an act of, I love this shul. I'm going to walk over every branch of this shul. I'm going to enter this exit, and I'm going to use every spot in the shul. That's what the Ivet Ravunis Nebshit says. It's about really, like, you know, being fully in the shul. I don't have a better theory. So, great. Next time, we will deal with lawn mowing in a destroyed synagogue. You may remember there was this rule that you can't mow the lawn in an old destroyed shul, so that people, when they see it, say, "Hey, remember when the grass used to be cut?" Now, we never had that problem at the old congregation, because the grass was never cut when it was in practice. Now that we're gone, the grass is finally cut. We're the opposite. But I say it in slight jest, but it's kind of true. But we're going to deal with that issue about mowing the lawn. And also, what about cemeteries and other things? Do these rules apply in cemeteries? What about, is a cemetery just where the graves are? Or what about like the perimeter, or like the war memorial at Lincoln Park, you know, or the other, the roads? And that's the rabbit hole we'll go down, and then the Torah reading. So a brief thing about kind of grass, lawn mowing, and cemeteries. I know this is all very mundane, but these are the laws in the Talmud. And then we'll get to the order of the special Torah readings for our conclusion, I think. So.
Just off topic, we're doing Zohar as usual tomorrow.
Zohar tomorrow at noon. We will be doing continuing with the Zohar's take on King David's sin with Bathsheba. Why an attempt to exonerate David from his adultery and murder in mystical fashion, the Talmud does. So if you're interested in that topic, whether you've been with us for the Zohar or not, King David, tomorrow there will be sex, there will be murder, there will be royalty and politics, all at noon in the Zohar, this Zoom channel. I hope to see you there.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, everyone. So I appreciate it. Just to review what we did tonight very briefly, so you remember, we started with Midrashim about Mount Sinai, and gaiva and arrogance and spirituality. And then we went on to the rules of shortcuts, basically making a synagogue a shortcut. Yes, no, why and why not? Easement exceptions and the general theory of it, with a lot of digressions, but hopefully we're really teasing out. Oh, and we quoted the tradition that the shuls are going to fly to Israel in the future, which is pretty significant. And this other idea in the Ben Yoyada, that's not that the mountains went here or the shuls are going to go there, but the mountains and the shuls have souls or spirit shadows. And is it about the people or the place? And that's where we were tonight. Never a dull moment on Tuesday Night Talmud. Have a great week, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.